Our legal system rests on a simple philosophical principle. It's better to let a guilty person go free than put an innocent person into jail. Our whole justice system is organized around this simple little principle. All the checks and balances that we have in our legal system are designed to produce that outcome, to err on the side of a person's potential innocence at the expense of a person's potential guilt. Do you agree with this principle? Do you agree with it? That it's better to let a guilty person go free than to put an innocent person into jail. Because it comes with certain costs. It means that guilty people get off quite a bit of time in our system. We see that all the time in the news. We read news reports of someone who seems so obviously guilty getting off somehow. And this happens because mostly happens because the burden of proof for a conviction of a charge, of a criminal charge in our system is very, very high. Beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard for proof rests on the idea that it's better to let a guilty person go free than to put an innocent person into jail. Beyond a reasonable doubt means that the prosecution must present evidence so compelling that no rational person could reasonably question the defendant's guilt. It's not absolute certainty. That absolute certainty is an impossible standard to meet, but it does mean a high degree of certainty. So again, I ask you, what do you think about this principle? Do you agree with it? Better to let a guilty person go free than to put an innocent person into jail. Because it doesn't have to be this way. We could come up with another principle to organize our legal system on. We could base our legal system on a whole different kind of principle. We could say the opposite, for instance. Better to put an innocent person into jail than to let a guilty person go free. We could err on that side. Imagine a criminal justice system built on the principle of emphasizing a person's guilt over their innocence. What would that look like, do you think? Well, it would be the opposite of our current reality. Less guilty people would get off for sure, but our jails would be filled with a lot more innocent people there. Would you be okay with that? If it meant that guilty people had less opportunity to go free. We're going to put a lot more innocent people into jail, but that's going to make sure that almost no one who's guilty is going to get off easily. Would that be a fair trade in your estimation? We could take the civil law standard of proof as the basis for our criminal justice system. The civil law standard of proof is the preponderance of the evidence. And that sounds like some big emphasis on proof, but in fact, the preponderance of the evidence is actually less than beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard of preponderance of the evidence. Preponderance of the evidence only means better than 50%. 50 plus 1% will get you a conviction. A person's guilt or innocence would depend on how the scale leans for them. Maybe it's a little bit guilty, so they're off the jail. If they're just a little bit more than 50-50 innocent, they're free. That kind of approach makes me a bit uncomfortable. Maybe a judge is having a bad day, just tilts in that favor of against you. Maybe you're off the jail because the judge had a fight with his wife or she had a fight with her husband, and you're in jail for that reason. That little difference tips the balance against you. Or maybe you get off because the judge is in a good mood, or the jury was in a happy mood that day, and they decided that on balance of probabilities, you're probably innocent. I'm not sure I'd want to put someone's freedom or their very life on that kind of fine distinction. See, we take our justice system for granted, but we often don't think deeply about what the underlying principles and assumptions are that it rests on. That's why in Canada we distinguish between being charged with a crime and being found guilty of a crime. Because the two standards of proof are so different from each other. To charge someone with a crime, to accuse them of a crime, is a much lower standard of proof than actually proving that it's true. And when I see people rushing to judgment about a specific criminal situation or even a general life situation before there's been any testing of the facts behind the charges or the accusations, that worries me. And I think it should worry you too. Because we're undercutting the principle upon which our whole legal system rests. I think our moral system rests on this too. A person is innocent until proven guilty. Why? Because it's better that a guilty person go free than we put an innocent person into jail. That's the trade-off we make when we agree to this. But have you ever wondered where that standard comes from? The basis of our criminal law in Canada or even in the Western world? That it's better for a guilty person to go free than to put an innocent person to jail. Where did that standard come from? Because it's not a natural position in life to take. In most societies and in most cultures throughout time, the principle has always been better to punish the innocent lest the guilty get off scot-free. That seems to be the default throughout human history. In fact, the presumption in the ancient world and still in much of the modern world is that if you're charged with a crime, it's almost certain that you are guilty, period. That seems to be the default state of human justice. Accusation is almost essentially the equivalent of guilt. Let's be honest. If you saw me being pulled out of Trillium in handcuffs, and then you discovered on the newspaper and on TV that I'd been charged with some sex crime or some other salacious crime, would you assume I'm guilty? I think most of you would hope that you're wrong about this, but I think you would assume I'm guilty. Deep down, I think you would. I think you'd hope that it wasn't true. I think you'd be praying that you were wrong about this assumption about my circumstances, that I had been falsely accused. But let's be honest, as devastating as it would be to admit it, deep down in our hearts, I think most of us would believe that I would be guilty. I must be guilty. Otherwise, why would the police be charging me, arresting me, and charging me with a crime? But let's just say, for sake of argument, that things go to trial and I'm found not guilty of the charges because our system values the freedom of the innocent over the punishment of the guilty. Just imagine that for a moment. Would my reputation be restored to me? Would I be able to return to the full esteem and trust that I currently enjoy from you at Trillium? Would I even still have a job here, even if I was found not guilty? I've been a pastor for 25 years now. My ability to do the job rests on your trust. That trust is only a smear or an accusation from being lost. It's a fragile thing, you know, trust. In the ancient world, to be accused was to be guilty. We need to remember that. In the ancient world, by and large, to be accused was to be guilty. It was that simple, really. Accusation and guilt were tightly bound to each other, not a lot of daylight between them. And the reason for this was that in the ancient world, the most important concern, their operating principle, was that a guilty person should not be able to get off free. That was the principle they worked from. A guilty person needed to be punished for what they had done. And when accusation and guilt are tightly bound, then it becomes easy to separate guilt from innocence because innocent people don't get accused. Simple as that. Innocent people don't get accused. You know, in the ancient world, in the Greek world at least, the word for discretion or prudence meant to keep your head down. Well, the idea was that you were trying to be obscure, not to get anybody's attention. You didn't want the attention of the gods, and you didn't want the attention of your community either. The idea was to move through life inconspicuous, so people didn't notice you. Because if they didn't notice you, they couldn't accuse you. That was the underlying idea behind prudence and discretion. Better to stay part of the herd, where you can't easily be singled out. You know, when you stand in front of people and you sing or you read or speak or whatever you might do in front of people, if you get their attention, there's always the risk that you could fall. Over the past several months, we've been going through the stained glass stories of Jesus that are found in the Trillium Building. There are 15 stories, a couple that never were put in, but they were meant to be. All the stained glass in the sanctuary tells the story of Jesus from his birth all the way around to his resurrection and ascension and everything in between. We started the series back on January 26th, and we've gone through all the stained glass panels. That's why today, even though it's Palm Sunday, we're actually in the scene over on this side here of Jesus standing before Pilate, because I think Palm Sunday was like 5 or 6 weeks ago in the stained glass story of Jesus. Starting with Jesus' birth, now, as they say, we're standing before with Jesus before Pilate's seat. And the one thing you can say about Jesus was that he was no wallflower. He was no wallflower. He didn't seem to get the memo of the ancient world that the best way to live a good life was to keep your head down and not draw attention to yourself. Jesus flew high as he embarked upon God's mission. And the crowds began to gather around him. They got bigger and bigger and bigger as his notoriety grew. And then Jesus began to contest with the Pharisees and the scribes about who God was and what true religion looked like. So this was someone who was definitely not trying to be inconspicuous. And as things reached a climax of sorts when Jesus entered into the holy city, Jerusalem, on a donkey. Remember that moment when he's coming in on the donkey and the crowds are thronging around him and they're cheering him on, lots of crowds and people celebrating. And that moment, Jesus' reputation and power was supreme. And he was able to contest with the temple authorities and the religious leaders of ancient Judaism on equal terms with them. He contested with those who ran the temple, which was the center point of the Jewish religion. And then it all unraveled in 1 week. It all unwound and unraveled as it always inevitably does. And there's a reason why in the ancient world people believed that prudence and piety was all about making oneself inconspicuous and invisible. Because the higher you go, the farther you fall. The counter-revolution got underway against Jesus. The authorities began to conspire against Jesus. The crowd started losing faith in Jesus. Even Jesus' own core team began to break apart under the pressure of that week. And then things finally blew up. And there's Judas going off to the authorities to betray Jesus. And there's Peter being confronted by the possibility of him being a disciple of Jesus. And him denying Jesus three times. Three times given the opportunity to identify with Jesus, three times he denies that connection with the Lord. And everyone who was part of Jesus' core team vanished when the moment came for them to step forward. And Jesus is completely isolated and alone. That's how much the unwinding had come to him. And it continued because Jesus got arrested and brought to trial before the Sanhedrin. You know, that's the Jewish law court. The trial took place in the middle of the night. What do you think about that? Can you find justice in the middle of the night? Jesus was accused of many things, accused of claiming to be God, being the Son of God, accused of threatening the destruction of the temple. And even all the facts of the trial didn't really add up to a conclusion. It didn't really matter. Being accused was enough. He was accused of these things, and that was enough to convict him. Jesus' unwinding is continuing because the Jewish authorities take Jesus to Pilate. They bring him before Pilate, and they make a new accusation against him. They claim that he is a revolutionary and insurrectionist against the state. This is the one charge the Romans would take seriously, which is why they brought it against him. They just made it up. But to be accused is enough in the ancient world. It's hard to know what Pilate really thought about all this. Did he think Jesus was a real and imminent threat to the Roman Empire? Did he really think Jesus could bring the Roman Empire down or even threaten it in any substantial way? Probably not, right? But there's that old saying, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, right? So there may be some truth to what the Jewish authorities are saying against Jesus when they accuse him of being a revolutionary. So Pilate crushed Jesus. Don't be suckered in by Pilate's challenging the Jewish authorities about Jesus' innocence. Pilate crushes Jesus, has him scourged, sends him out to his bodyguards, and they bodyguards, what do? They mock him. They beat him. They spit on him. They slap him in the face. They put a false crown on his head made of thorns. They put these robes of royal purple upon him, and then they bow down to him and make mockery of their allegiance to him as king of the Jews. This is the king of the Jews, as they scourge him. It's only when Jesus has been beaten and humiliated that Pilate brings him out again. He parades him in front of the crowd or in front of the authorities. "Behold the man," he says. "Behold the man." I think it's really important that you understand that in that moment, Jesus is a beaten and broken person. Certainly his body is beaten and broken to a pulp. "Behold the man." It's kind of an off-putting joke, a bad joke that Pilate makes. I think Pilate didn't think Jesus was really guilty of the crime, but it didn't really matter because he was accused and he needed to be disposed of, and that was enough. And there's just one more little step for Jesus to go. The unwinding is unfolding through his life, and he's just got one more step. In fact, it's up there on that last pane of glass there beside Jesus and Pilate. In this moment, when Pilate parades Jesus before the crowd, there is no mercy. There's no forgiveness. There's only a simple cry for punishment. Crucify him. One thing the four gospel writers want you to know in the midst of all of this, they all agree on this. There are little differences they don't agree on, but in all of this, they have one thing they most certainly agree on. They want you to know that Jesus was innocent of the charges brought against him. Do you believe them, that he was innocent? They maintain that the accusations directed towards Jesus were false and erroneous, and that they did not justify his conviction, his sentence to death. What do you say to their assertion of this fact? If the gospel writers are correct, that means Jesus joined the ranks of the unjustly convicted. In fact, what the gospel writers say is even more radical than this. Jesus actually created the category of the unjustly convicted. It's not that Jesus was, in truth, the first person falsely accused and punished for a serious crime. Of course not. He joined a long lineage of people who had suffered that kind of event in their life. Jesus would not have been the first person to have suffered capital punishment for a crime he didn't commit. What made Jesus different was that he was the first person in history who was accused and convicted of a serious crime, a capital crime, where some, after the fact, maintained his innocence, where some, after the fact, dissented from his punishment, and where some, after the fact, still protested his conviction. I don't think we fully appreciate just how radical a moment this is in human history. Jesus' trial, his conviction and death shattered a way of seeing the world and of seeing each other, of people seeing each other, where accusations and guilt were understood to be bedfellows. In the unwinding of Jesus, he unwound a whole system of crime and punishment, where accusation and guilt were synonymous with each other. Our legal system rests today on a simple philosophical principle. It's better to let a guilty person go free than to put an innocent person in jail. And I ask you, where do you thought this idea came from? Well, I can tell you now that the whole Western justice system, our whole basis of justice, how we understand justice, and our emphasis on protecting the potential of someone's innocence over the potential of someone's guilt, it rests on this story here today in the Gospels, and on that pane of glass there, the depiction of the story on that pane of glass. Jesus' trial and conviction, where an innocent person was put to death, becomes the basis of our understanding going forward of what true justice looks like. It's not just any person who was falsely accused and executed. This was the Son of God. This was the Messiah, the Lord, the Prince of Peace, the one who bears the face of God to us. It was this one, our Lord, who was falsely accused and convicted. And the lesson from this moment for us is straightforward. If we missed it with him, if we overlooked the distinction between accusation and guilt in him, if we missed it in him, the one who comes in all grace and truth to us, if we missed it with him, we will most certainly miss it with each other. It's Jesus' story and the gap between accusation and guilt that begins to open up, that shapes our legal system, has shaped it for hundreds and hundreds of years. It took a long time and a special person to show us the way. And it's taken us a long time to build a legal system that respects the truth that accusation and guilt are not the same thing. They're not bedfellows with each other. To build a legal system that prioritizes a person's potential innocence over their potential guilt is revolutionary. And it seems to me that if we are serious about following Jesus Christ, we of all people, need to be vigilant in recognizing the substantial gap between, the giant hole even, between what lies, let me say this again. We of all people need to be vigilant in recognizing the substantial gap that lies between accusation and guilt. Because if we don't remember the difference, and we don't remind the culture that we live in about the difference, that the simple philosophical principle we've been talking about, that it's better to prefer the innocence, the potential of someone's innocence, than the potential of their guilt. It's better to let a guilty person go free than to punish an innocent person. If we forget about this and we don't remind our culture about it, it too will forget about it. And this will ultimately lead to our own unwinding and unraveling as a civilization.